I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. A few weeks ago, Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler sat down with three local Muslim American women to reflect on their place in the culture and how they and their religion are perceived by the press, by the public, and politicians this campaign season. Here's an edited portion of their conversation.
You're listening to Radio Times. I'm Elizabeth Fiedler, in for Marty Moscow. We're talking this hour about the lives of Muslim women in the Philadelphia area and how they're reacting to recent local events and to some comments that have been made in the presidential campaign. I'm joined in studio by three guests. Faria Khan is the Associate Director of the Asian American Studies Program at the University of Pennsylvania, and she serves on the Governor's Advisory Commission on Asian Pacific American Affairs. I'm also joined by Sophia Ali Khan, a Muslim American public interest lawyer and writer, and Camila Mukmin Rashad, the Muslim chaplain at the University of Pennsylvania and founder of the nonprofit Muslim Wellness Foundation. Faria, Camila, and Sophia, thank you all for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Now, you're all Muslim women, but you have a variety of experiences and perspectives, obviously. And I want to get to the ongoing presidential campaign, because I know that's on all of your minds. But first, let's talk about your identity as Muslim women living in the Philadelphia area. And specifically, I'd like to talk a little bit about the hijab. First, Camila, I'd like to begin with you. You wear a headscarf. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you feel that that outward sign of your religion has prompted people in any way to comment. Do they comment on your decision to cover? Have they treated you differently?
You know, I was born and raised Muslim. I'm originally from Brooklyn, New York, and came to Philadelphia as an undergrad at Penn. And because I think I've been fortunate enough to live in cities where there's a large Muslim community, that wearing a headscarf or wearing hijab, or even the decision not to wear, was not something that kind of became a huge topic of discussion. I think more recently, I've been questioned about why I wear hijab. Someone said to me, you know, and again, probably very out of curiosity, I guess being honest, you know, said, well, you seem like such an intelligent person. You know, why do you cover? And I'm assuming that underlying some of those comments was, you know, a feeling that, again, the stereotype that Islam is oppressive, that women are not free to make their own decisions. And so there's some of those kinds of, I think, slight comments or just kind of curiosity about being Muslim and being covered that I've encountered more recently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Faria, does this strike a chord for you at all personally? You don't wear the hijab, and I wonder whether people have commented on that fact to you that you don't cover.
I don't think that people have questioned whether or not I cover, but I think that my identity as a Muslim and as an immigrant, I mean, I'm a brown Pakistani woman, I don't think that that has the lack of wearing hijab has protected me. I think I'm still identified as the other, as an immigrant. You know, just within the past 6 months, I received a compliment on how good my English is, despite the fact that I've always gone to school in the U.S., that I am actually American, right, by citizenship and by my patriotic allegiance to the country. So I don't think that wearing it has, or not wearing it, has marked me differently.
And have people commented at all to you? I think at an earlier, some comments that you had before, you'd mentioned that people had said something about being glad that you didn't wear it, that they felt more comfortable speaking to you.
Well, I had given a talk at a neighborhood group where one of the women actually had asked me after I spoke about Islam. She said, you know, I don't understand this scarf. It really actually frightens me when I see women wearing it. And I see that you're not wearing it. You look like us. Mm. So what's that about? So, you know, instantly I felt like, well, she clearly saw me as the other, no matter how much I felt a part of the neighborhood or part of the landscape that is the U.S., I was still being identified as the other.
Camila, I heard you. I heard you make a sound when she mentioned that. Have you heard things like that, or what, how does that make you feel?
Well, I think, unfortunately, Muslim women, like, all of what we, who we are, what we think about, becomes reduced by whether or not you know, whether you're hijabi or not. And I have so many friends, you know, who wear turbans, who wear galas, who wear hijab, who don't. And there's so much more that we discuss about our daily lives and our experiences. But those are the times that, you know, it becomes reduced, like there's sides that you have to choose. And, you know, your religiosity and kind of your identity is sort of reduced and kind of boiled down to whether or not your hair is covered. And I've also encountered that, like, well, you know, maybe you would kind of assimilate more, or you would be seen as more acceptable if you don't cover. And, you know, it's always interesting to me, again, that we don't sort of investigate and kind of interrogate where that idea is coming from, that there is a certain way of being that's more acceptable. And if you in some way deviate from that, then that means that, well, perhaps your citizenship or your identity should be kind of under question or under scrutiny. And that's just, you know, just unfair.
And Fouria, you mentioned something earlier that I wanted to pick up on, and then I'll bring you into the conversation, Sophia. You mentioned that even though you're American, people have made comments. You're American, you have a PhD, you have a master's, you grew up here, people still make comments on how good your English is, things like that. And I know one term, forever foreigner, is a term that you teach in your class. Could you tell me what that means and how you feel like that applies to your life here in the U.S.?
Sure. So forever foreigner is a concept that the immigrant remains a foreigner, right? And actually, despite naturalization or despite actually having the U.S. as a birthplace, they are perceived as the other. They're perceived as a foreigner within their own homeland, right? That they must be coming from somewhere else because they are from a different race. They may possess a different religion. They may have a particular heritage that's seen as too foreign within the U.S. So I have definitely felt, you know, the forever foreigner, despite having grown up here, having, you know, attended school here. It I guess, you know, in certain situations, it doesn't matter that my passport says U.S. because I'm perceived as an outsider in many circumstances.
Right. Interesting. And Sophia, I don't know if you want to comment on that. I did want to ask you also, would you like to comment on that first?
Sure. On hijab. So it's interesting because I think one of the things that has been really clear to me in almost every discussion about hijab that I've been part of or have heard, it centers on sort of identity politics. And I think, so I wore hijab for many years. I don't anymore. I wore it when I was practicing law in Philadelphia. I was an attorney for Community Legal Services, and I worked in the North Philadelphia office, which actually is a very, very heavily Muslim, at least business district, if not residentially heavily Muslim. And for me, I just actually wrote a piece on this called Bandaging My Wounds, A Spiritual Journey Through Hijab for Alt Muslima, which is an online Muslim feminist magazine. And it really focused much more for me on my perception of hijab as a spiritual tool for myself, mm-hmm. right? Something that gave me something spiritually that no other tool could at that time. I was deeply affected by a divorce. I was deeply affected by 9/11. And hijab offered me a sort of protection, a sort of comfort, and a sort of spiritual deepening that I happened to need at that time in my life.
And did you feel differently when you were wearing it, or did you feel you were perceived differently when you were wearing it, especially up in North Philly where you mentioned you were practicing as a lawyer?
Yeah, I think Philadelphia is really interesting in that way. I think I may have felt differently in another place, but in North Philadelphia, hijab actually is met with a certain level of respect and even deference. So, you know, where I might have been harassed on the street, there was silence. I could walk down the street sort of unafflicted. Mm-hmm. I even got sort of nods. I got salamu alaikum. I got a really welcoming response. I think partly that's because it was specifically North Philadelphia, but I think also we happen to live in a place, in a city that has a lot of Muslims in it. We have very high concentrations of a great diversity of Muslim communities. I think the Pluralism Project out of Harvard University identified, I think, 145 different faith-based organizations in our city, and 30 of those were Muslim. So
It's a really high concentration.
And I'd like to move on a little bit, looking at some of the incidents that have happened in Philadelphia. I know over the last few months in the Philadelphia area, there have been a number of things that have caught the attention of people, not just locally, but internationally. A few months ago in December, there was stepped-up police presence across the city at worship houses after a maintenance worker at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in North Philadelphia found a severed pig's head outside of the building. Then in January, a man who ambushed a police officer and fired more than a dozen shots at point-blank range claimed he was acting in the name of Islam. I do know in that case there have been quite a few questions about his true motivations and about his mental health. And then later in January, an incident that a couple folks had mentioned to me on a Saturday night in Center City, a 34-year-old man said he was punched by men who told him to stop speaking Arabic. I mention all of those, obviously, in addition to some of the others that have happened in Brussels and Paris, those being supported by the Islamic State. I wonder, Faria, for you as a mother of three, you were born in Pakistan, but you were raised in the U.S. Have these incidents had an effect on you? Have they affected your family? Is this something you're talking about at the dinner table?
We do talk about it. I mean, the news is frightening. I mean, it's there's really no other way to describe it for the kids. It's very difficult. They're trying to make sense of their religious faith and what's going on and how it's portrayed in the news, right? And
I'm sorry to interrupt. Remind me how the ages of your children, if you would.
So I have an 11-year-old, I have a 15-year-old, and I have a 17-year-old. So, you know, the one incident where the man shot the police officer, that actually ended up being an issue of mental health. And I think what saddens me about that issue is that it was certainly broadcast as a terrorist event, but there was no follow-up that actually that man had severe issues with mental health. And that's really too bad because the stain that it left was, you know, done, right? I think that what is deeply troubling is the slippage and equivalence between terrorism and Islam.
We're going to have to leave it there for just a second. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Elizabeth Fiedler, in for Marty Moskowain.
And we'll get back to Liz Fiedler's interview after a very short break, recorded just a few weeks ago. And coming up later in the show, I'll talk with Pakistani writer Bina Shah about how the West misunderstands the lives of Afghan women. She wrote about that recently in the New York Times, and she'll be joining us from Karachi in Pakistan. For more information and to react to this interview, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. That's whyy.org/radiotimes. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moskowain, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. We're playing portions of Liz Fiedler's interview with three Muslim American women who live in the Philadelphia area, recorded a few weeks ago. They've been talking about the hijab and their lives. Here's Faria Khan describing her concerns about the treatment of her children because of their religion.
For my kids who've really grown up in this environment, it's deeply problematic, right? You know, my children have been called terrorists, and they, you know, I think the first time that my one son was called terrorist, it was really troubling because when I went to the school and said, there's a huge issue with Islamophobia, what is being addressed about this? But the school sort of looked at me like, what is the problem? They didn't actually understand that there are larger issues here and that they needed to address discrimination and ultimately really racism, right, within the school district. The second time that it happened, I did say to my older son, your brother has been called a terrorist. You know, maybe this is a time that you could be a little bit more supportive. And I think what made me distraught was my older son responded with, what's the big deal? I get called terrorist all the time, right? Mm-hmm. So he had experienced a desensitization to the fact that he'd been called terrorist. He'd been seen as a Muslim terrorist, right, within the school. And so that kind of rhetoric is deeply troubling. It's really problematic.
Sophia, I saw you nodding. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think I'll just go back to your original, you know, the list of events. I think it's really interesting that we put them together because two of those, the pig at the pig's head at the mosque and the man being attacked for speaking Arabic are Islamophobic events, right? And then we have a purportedly, at least, religious Muslim identified extremist attack. And what's interesting to me about taking those three things together is that I think as Americans, we need to recognize that all three, both of those, the Islamophobic attacks as well as the religiously identified extremist attacks, they all pose a threat to our security, to our families, to our communities. For us, you know, that kind of violence or vandalism or hatred, it has the same effect as tearing apart the fabric.
I'm talking about the lives of Muslim women in Philadelphia with Sophia Ali Khan, a Muslim American public interest lawyer and writer, Faria Khan, the associate director of the Asian American Studies Program at Penn, and Camila Mukmin Rashad, the Muslim chaplain at the University of Penn. Now let's get back to our discussion. Sophia, your parents came to the U.S. from the southern part of Pakistan, and I understand they were trying to escape, among other things, political instability, which perhaps gives you an interesting perspective given the current climate and the fact that you grew up in Bucks County, were the only Muslim student in your graduating class. I wonder how, if you'd like to add anything further about sort of what's happening, you know, globally with Islamic State, the fact that people are talking about Islamophobia, there's a rise in it, how it's affecting you personally.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think when I was growing up as the only Muslim besides my brother in a fairly large school district, you know, my graduating class was 600 or 800 kids, I experienced ignorance, right? Like I can recount events where teachers, you know, sent me out of the room to wash off what was actually henna, but what they thought was orange magic marker, or and were mad when it didn't come off. Or I could recount, you know, the time when I was asked to run the mile while I was fasting for Ramadan, and the gym teacher said, "Well, what's that?" when I explained why I couldn't run the mile. Those are events that I can look back at and say, well, that's ignorance. They lacked, maybe they didn't respond well, but they lacked knowledge. And that was the primary problem. The problem that I'm concerned about with my own children, who are 3 and 5, is that what I anticipate them encountering is much more what Fariha was talking about, hatred, actual animosity, a sense that, yeah, we know what Islam is, and I'm going to tell you what it is, that non-Muslims are going to have that attitude towards them, and it's nothing good. So, and I think as a parent of a 3 and a 5-year-old, I always wonder sort of when the appropriate time to start having those conversations is.
Right.
My sister-in-law, for example, said that she had deferred having those conversations with her, I think now third grader, my niece. And until one day my niece came home and said, in a conversation, general conversation, "But Mama, Muslims aren't good people." And here she is, a Muslim, saying to her mother that her identity had been defined in this really formative way by her peers who saw Islam in a negative light. So that's sort of terrifying, and it really makes me rethink how early I need to start explaining not just what Islam is, which of course we do all the time, but to say not everyone sees us this way, you know, mm-hmm. to somehow incorporate that 80 to 90% of the news feed on Muslims is negative. It's just difficult to know how to do that for a 3 and a 5-year-old.
Faria, do you have
help? Yeah, Sophia, so I would recommend doing it sooner than later. You know, I made the mistake of actually telling, not really discussing 9/11 or some of the Islamophobic events and thoughts to my 10-year-old. But she came home after 9/11 and said, "Mom, do you know today is 9/11? And I said, "Yes, I do know that." She said, "Well, we had a moment of silence at school. And after that, a lot of kids were asking us about, you know, the event and why we had a moment of silence. So our teacher showed us live footage of these planes that crash into buildings. Now I'm really scared. I really don't think I want to fly anymore." Mm-hmm. And then after she showed the news footage, she showed a video on Muslims to the kids. So that was a direct correlation, right? Here's this horrifying, tragic event, and here is the life of Muslims, right? And I assure you that those Muslims in that video were brown, like me. So what does that teach our children in the fifth grade? It teaches them that you have A and you have B, and they're connected, right? Mm-hmm. You have Islam and you have terrorists, and those things are equatable. And so my regret is that I wasn't ahead of that game.
Interesting. And Camila, I wonder if you have thoughts on this personally and or as the Muslim chaplain at Penn, or maybe those brains share the same thoughts.
Well, I would echo Faria's advice to have the conversation early. My daughter, who's 13, when she's in social studies and they're talking about how to use the media and, you know, representations of all different kinds of people, one of her classmates said to her, "Well, isn't your mom a part of ISIS?" And she's like, "No, my mom is a psychology student. She's a chaplain at Penn." And she was so frustrated and hurt because she's looking to the adult in the room to respond and to say that's not appropriate. And so in the same way that I've had conversations with my daughter, and my son is 11, about race, it's now having conversations about race and religion and what their very specific experiences like, it's almost like they have this added burden of having to explain and justify. And honestly, from middle school, elementary school to college, many of them are exhausted. You know, they're like, "When will this end? I'm tired. I have exams." Like, I have just pressures and stress of daily living like everyone else, in addition to the fact that now I have to prove to everyone that I'm not a threat, I'm not a terrorist.
But Camila, I would say too that I feel that way. I mean, I know the kids do, but I'm exhausted well from the rhetoric, right? I'm exhausted having to legitimize myself in the eyes of my friends, my neighbors, people that I work with, people that I teach, right? Mm-hmm. That something happens in Pakistan. Well, I now need to be the spokesperson and explain that this happened, but that this is very different from the faith that I practice, from how my family identifies on these issues. Right. And I'm tired from it, too. I'm tired of being the spokesperson.
Yeah, it's not only explain it, but go clean up your own backyard is the message that I get repeatedly.
Absolutely.
You know, like that I individually am somehow responsible. And before I can speak out on Islamophobia, I need to make sure that Islamic extremism is taken care of, even if the seed of it is halfway around the world from me, even if it's so very different from the faith that I practice.
And I'll stop you right there. I'm sorry. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Elizabeth Fiedler in for Marty Moskowain, talking about the lives and reactions of Muslim women in America with Sophia Ali Khan, a Muslim American public interest lawyer and writer, Camila Rashad, the Muslim chaplain at Penn, and Faria Khan, the associate director of the Asian American Studies Program at Penn. Now let's get back to our discussion. Sophia, go ahead. I'm sorry if I cut you off. I know you wrote a Facebook post that I believe went viral after you put it up. Could you read us a passage from it? And I guess it was in response to some of these presidential candidates' remarks.
Right. It was written the evening, I think, that Donald Trump proposed banning Muslims from entering America and failed to specify which Muslims. And there was a lot of attention to that comment. So I wrote initially to a very limited group of friends, "Dear non-Muslim allies, I'm writing to you because it has gotten just that bad. I found myself telling too many people about the advice given to me years ago by the late composer Herbert Brun, a German Jew who fled Germany at the age of 15. He said, 'Be sure that your passport is in order.'
It's not enough to laugh at Donald Trump anymore. The rhetoric about Muslims has gotten so nasty and is everywhere, on every channel, every newsfeed. It is clearly fueling daily events of targeted violence, vandalism, vigilante harassment, and discrimination. I want you to know that it has gotten bad enough that my family and I talk about what to keep on hand if we have to leave quickly, and where we should go, maybe if the election goes the wrong way, or if folks get stirred up enough to be dangerous before the election. When things seem less scary, we talk about a 5 or 10 year plan to go somewhere where cops don't carry guns and hate speech isn't allowed on network television. And if you don't already know this about me, I want you to know that I was born in this country.
Thank you for reading that. And Sophia, I understand that you and your husband, you mentioned, have been talking about what if you moved out of the U.S. Tell me about those conversations. How difficult are they? Do you think your children have any sense that these times could be so serious?
Yeah. I mean, I think we're in kind of an unusual situation. My husband was born and raised in Britain, ethnically Pakistani like I am. I was born and raised here. He's a permanent resident, and we talk about him applying for citizenship. And so when we're having that conversation, the question is, well, what would he be giving up by doing that? You know, would he be giving up the security of maybe the British government doing something if we were, you know, if there was a press to intern Muslims or persecute Muslims? I mean, post 9/11, we saw a lot of instances of people being really railroaded, academics, folks who were anti-occupation in Palestine. We saw those folks being really railroaded. And so there was a concern that, you know, the protections of his British citizenship were important to him. And my thought was, well, you know, if we have to be concerned about that, then maybe we should be thinking about whether this country is getting to a place where, you know, Islamophobia will deeply affect the lives of our children and our family, and we need to start thinking about options. It sounds crazy a little bit in the light of day, to be honest. I was born and raised here. I was born in Florida. I was raised in Bucks County. I mean, I went to the same school system that my children would go to in Bucks County. And so it really seems like a crazy set of things to think about. But you know, when you see presidential candidates talking about shutting down your houses of worship, you go to those places. You wonder.
And Camila, I know one of Trump's comments, Donald Trump's comments about restricting the movement of Muslims coming into the U.S., mm-hmm. I know that struck a particular chord with your family. Can you tell me about that, about your daughter's fears about that?
Yeah, it was that comment. And my older two children definitely follow. They'll watch the debates with me. And now I wonder whether or not I should continue to let them do that. But I think it was after that comment by Trump. And also, I think he won the Nevada caucus. My daughter said, like, he could win. He could be the president. She said, are we going to leave? And where would we go? And she said, well, will you stop wearing hijab? Like all of these questions, like what if? And then she asked me, my younger sister was deployed in Jordan. She said, well, will my aunt be able to come back? Will Zakiya be able to come back to the country if he's president? And, you know, I was just kind of stunned. I was in disbelief, you know, and I was also angry, you know, that because my family, again, a descendant of enslaved Africans, you know, that we've, you know, I can trace and I have traced my family back to like the 1830s to a plantation in Tennessee. And so for my daughter, you know, to wonder whether or not this country is safe for her and whether or not her relatives will be able to, you know, to reenter and whether or not I'll have to in some way disguise myself and not be, you know, perceived or you know, appear to be Muslim. You know, it left me kind of astounded because how do I explain that to my daughter that this is her country of birth and, you know, kind of the story of how our family arrived is already painful, you know, to have this painful conversation that she may in some way be ostracized or excluded as a citizen was really troubling to me.
And to try to explain to her that her aunt who's serving in the military might, that she has real concerns whether she could come back into the United States after serving abroad.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, I think these are the stories that I really want people to know, that we all, we're human. And so when we hear Donald Trump make a comment like that, or Ted Cruz, I don't think that they are aware of the very real impact, like the visceral impact, or whether or not they care. But the fact that it's very painful, it's hurtful for a variety of different reasons, and that it's troubling because there are people who then begin to act on those comments, and somehow feel sanctioned to, you know, either take that rhetoric to another level, and it could be lethal, and in some cases it has.
We've been talking about life in Philadelphia and about the presidential campaign, among other things, with three Muslim women who live in the Philadelphia area. Faria, Camila, and Sophia, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Elizabeth, so much.
My guests today have been Faria Khan, the Associate Director of the Asian American Studies Program at the University of Pennsylvania, Sophia Ali Khan, a Muslim American public interest lawyer and writer, and Camila Mukmin Rashad, the Muslim chaplain at the University of Pennsylvania and founder of the nonprofit Muslim Wellness Foundation. Thank you all so much for being here. You're listening to Radio Times. I'm Elizabeth Fiedler, in for Marty Moscowane.
And again, Liz Fiedler and her three guests talking about living here in the Philadelphia area. An interview that was recorded a few weeks ago. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out more about that interview. Well, we're up on a break, and when we return, I'll be talking with Bina Shah. She'll be joining us from Karachi, Pakistan. She wrote an op-ed in the New York Times that caught our eye. She'll be joining us to discuss the lives of Afghan women. I should add, her latest book is called A Season for Martyrs. So stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler was just talking with three Muslim women living in the Philadelphia area about their lives. Joining us now by Skype is Bina Shah. She's a writer who lives in Karachi, Pakistan. She wrote a piece for the New York Times that caught our eye a few weeks ago about the myths and misunderstandings that Westerners have about Afghan women, seeing them as powerless victims of their culture. We asked her to join us and explain. And Bina Shah, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I have to say that we tend to hear, certainly here in the U.S., about Afghan women if the story is about an honor killing or domestic violence or child brides. What are we missing?
Well, it's certainly true that most of what you hear is very grim coming out of Afghanistan. And I have to say that I, too, heard a lot about this from a much earlier time throughout the 1990s when the Taliban had taken over Afghanistan. And I had always thought, well, this is it for Afghan women. They're locked up in their homes. They have to wear burqas. They can't go to school. They can't go to college. They can't work. It looked really bad to me, too. And then I actually met some Afghan women when I traveled to Turkey in 2013. And these two women, they were young women, they were studying, they were poets and writers, and they completely turned my idea of what it meant to be an Afghan woman upside down. It totally changed my perspective. Instead of what I had been hearing merely through the media, for the first time I was actually seeing real Afghan women in front of me and realizing that their lives, although constricted for many years, were starting to go towards normalcy. And underneath it all, they were very much the same as I was. They wanted to study. They wanted opportunities to travel, to speak, to meet people freely. These women were not victims, and they were not oppressed. They were not depressed. They were very bold. They were very spirited. They were very alive. So that was something very important for me, and that's what I wanted to convey through my op-ed.
What was interesting, though, in the op-ed is that you couldn't reveal their names for security concerns. What does that tell us?
They both gave me permission to use their names in the op-ed. They both said, it's fine, you can name us. But I chose not to just because I'm overcautious. I'm always thinking about security for women. It continues to be a problem in many parts of the world. not just in Afghanistan or Pakistan or the Middle East, but even in the United States with things like Gamergate going on, where women's details have been revealed and they've been doxxed. So I'm always a little extra cautious about providing security to women when I write about them.
Let me quote you. You write, the self-image of a great many Afghan women doesn't match the victimhood awarded them by the Western aid workers. They see themselves as brave, capable, and strong. Islam is important to them, as is their honor. They want more freedoms, of course, but they want to be active participants in their own liberation and set their own pace for the struggle. Are you saying that it's time for the West to go home and let Afghan women sort this out for themselves?
Not at all. That's not what I'm saying at all. And I think that's a misconception that has been propelled in the wake of the peace. Let me just tell you, I'm sure you've heard of Malala Yousafzai,
the
world's youngest Nobel Peace Prize winner. She is named after Malalai of My Wind, who is a famous Afghan heroine from the 19th century. She urged her compatriots to rise up against the British, and she was killed at the Battle of My Wind in 1880. So we're talking about a historical perspective of Afghan women, who have always fought for their liberation, who have always gathered in feminist collectives and gathered in groups and gathered privately and publicly to further the cause of their own liberation. And what I'm saying is that many of the Western aid programs that were designed to help Afghan women in the wake of Taliban rule and in the wake of the invasion, the post-9/11 invasion, these aid programs, the people who designed them didn't so much as bother to even do the research on the ground. They didn't so much bother as to talk to the Afghan women that they would be affecting with these programs about their goals, about their concerns, about what their objectives might be. And so there was a huge disconnect in these types of programs that were being created and how the Afghan women wanted to conduct their own lives going forward.
Well, as
I said...
No, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
What I said in my piece was that, you know, Western development needs to backtrack from that mistake. It can continue to support. We want, I mean, Afghan women definitely need allies throughout the world, but what they need is to be listened to and heard and for their values and ideas to be respected in that process.
You also remind those of us that are not as familiar with Afghan history as you are and others are, that in 1964, women got the right to vote in Afghanistan. 1977, there were equal rights. Do those still exist?
Well, Afghanistan has historically been a deeply socially conservative society, and a lot of the modernization was taken forward by leaders who were, by their presidents or the kings, who were interested in creating a more westernized or more secularized society. Now, of course, there's going to be an element in that society which is very eager to have these freedoms and wants to go forward with them. Then there's going to be the parts of society which are more traditional, less educated. They may be more reluctant to do so. But it's important to remember that you can't lump all the Afghan women into one category. There are those that want to go forward quickly. There are those that want to go forward more slowly. And there needs to be programs that take both those camps into account.
And what would those programs look like?
Well, I think that they wouldn't necessarily have to be a complete break because there is so much research going on currently academically. There are development workers there that are on the ground. There are people that have spent a lot of time with Afghan women. I've quoted some of them in my piece. Why not consult with them? Why not read the books that they've written about what the Afghan women value and what they want and what their lives are like? You don't have to reinvent the wheel. You could actually just do your homework properly.
And why do you think that didn't happen? Is it that the a sense that as Westerners or maybe even Western feminists that somehow we know better?
I think there was an over-eagerness on the part of the people that wanted to get into Afghanistan and liberate women from the Taliban. I mean, that was very much an ideological goal. And I think they looked, rather than looking to Afghan women for the go-ahead, they instead looked to Western feminism for sort of the structure and the framework of what Western liberation looked like and tried to apply that to the Afghan context There was a huge disconnect. It created a backlash in many ways. In some places it worked. This is not a blanket condemnation, but a call for more subtlety, for more understanding of context, and for more nuance when you're doing delicate work like this.
You mentioned backlash, and are you referring to the you begin your article about a woman who's had her part of her nose cut off, and she was objecting to a marriage of a young girl, her husband taking a 7-year-old as a wife. Is that the kind of backlash you're talking about?
Well, you know, it's very obvious from that example that I started with that Afghan women are very aware of their own suffering. They don't need the West to tell them this is how you're suffering and this is what it shouldn't look like, you know. And I, in fact, got a backlash from my article from a lot of people saying, oh, so does that mean you're in favor of Afghan women having their noses cut off? Of course not. The point is that they do know what their suffering is. They're very aware of it, but they want to tell their own stories and they want to be supported, but they don't want to be forced or dragged into it or led into it by what they see as outside interference. They're very suspicious of this. Centuries of being invaded by various armies from various different nations have made them, the Afghan people, very, very wary of interference from anybody that's outside their own context.
I have heard some Afghan women talking about their concerns, maybe even fears, that if the U.S. were to leave and somehow the Taliban were to come back into power, that that would put them all back inside their homes, all back inside wearing burqas. Do you share that concern?
I think that's a very legitimate concern. I mean, the way things are going now in this part of the world, no battle has been completely declared a victory. And things can change at any minute. And, you know, there are peace negotiations going on at the moment. The Taliban are part of that peace process. That's just a reality of the situation. And unfortunately, women's rights seem to always be the first thing that's thrown under the bus. And that is a result of not enough women being involved in the peace negotiations, no women at the peace talks, no women at the tables, no women being thought of included in high levels of government that are, you know, dealing with these things. So obviously there's always the danger that women are going to be sacrificed for the sake of a peace that pleases everybody else.
That is Beena Shah. She's a writer. She's joining us by Skype from Karachi, Pakistan. And we called her up to join us on Radio Times, a piece that she had just a week or so ago in the New York Times titled Afghan Women, What the West Gets Wrong. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. We hear about, and we in the West, or we in the United States, who led the invasion in 2001. We hear about the number of girls now who are going to school, the numbers of schools that have been built in the last couple of years. And oftentimes that's framed that this is something that the West did for Afghanistan. True, not true, a piece of truth there?
I think it's definitely true. I can't stress the importance of the need for peace so that girls can go to school. But we had a similar situation in Pakistan where the Taliban took over Swat. That's a small part of our northwestern area. And our Pakistani army eventually defeated them, brought peace back to the nation, and the girls got back to school. So I think the point is that it's peace that's the requirement. It doesn't really have to do with who's bringing the peace. Once the peace comes, the girls can go to school. But I think what's being missed in the picture is that, you know, and I say this in my piece, that was excerpted from a longer essay that I wrote, in that feminism has always existed in Afghanistan. And this is something that people seem to not be able to comprehend. There are long established internal mechanisms that have been working in the country for decades. There are informal and formal women's groups, there are social safety nets, there are community organizers. During the Taliban's rule, there was an amazing group called RAWA, the Revolutionary Afghan Women's Association, and they were at great danger to themselves. They were taking pictures, they were reporting what was going on under Taliban rule. So it's wrong for us to think that the West walked in and did this for Afghan women. Afghan women have been trying to do this for themselves for decades.
The West certainly helped bring about the conditions in which then women could return to their somewhat normal lives. But things are still very shaky.
As you say, things are still very shaky. Are you, I mean, looking into the future and even beyond the women living in Afghanistan? And as you say, it's important to think of men and women. But do you have some degree of confidence that there can be some stability, more freedoms, a better life?
I have every confidence in Afghan women. I have every confidence that they are the ones that will lead the struggle. They are the ones whose vision will play out. I think they care deeply about themselves. They care deeply about the fates of their daughters. There's no doubt about that. And I completely refute the allegation that they're so oppressed that they don't know what freedom looks like, which is something that I heard after my op-ed was published. So I think that if they are given the space, and this is where Western organizations can come in helpfully, if they are given the space, their voices are amplified, and if this effort is a community effort that takes in both women and men rather than putting all the focus on women and sort of dismissing the men or treating them all as terrible villains, all as oppressors, if this is done carefully, intelligently, and balanced in a balanced manner that benefits the entire community, then I think the future can look very good.
Well, there's certainly women serving in the government. Do you see them as the sort of leaders of this, or is it a more sort of ground level movement?
Again, it's going to come from all sorts. You need ground level movement, but you also need women leaders symbolically. You need them because they're the ones that are going to advocate for women at the highest levels of power. You need them as role models. And you need them for, you know, morally and philosophically as well. The world is made up of men and women. So why exclude women from any level of society or leadership?
We're almost out of time here. You mentioned Malala Yousafzai, who got the Nobel Peace Prize. But what's interesting, and I think in the West, you know, thinks of her as almost like a near perfect teenage girl. And certainly her bravery is pretty extraordinary. But there's a lot of, as you write, some ambivalence in perhaps Afghanistan, in Pakistan, where you live, about Malala.
There's huge ambivalence, and this has partly been the right wing and conservative media, unfortunately, is to blame for this. They have painted her as, you know, a less than savory person, an agent of the West, an innocent child who's been duped into, you know, promoting a pro-Western agenda. All these things, and these are. These are internal ideological conflicts that we have already going on in our country. And then the figure of Malala is just very convenient. It's very convenient to hang all of that on this young woman's shoulders, unfairly so.
Well, Beena Shah, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, joining us by Skype from Karachi, Pakistan. And she is a writer. She has written a number of pieces for The New York Times. She's also written a number of works of fiction. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Tell us what you think of this hour of the show. You can tell us what you think about many hours of the show as well. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back with Hour 2.